And now, welcome to Oasis Forum, where we explore issues that can help us positively evolve our lives, our society, and our planet. Oasis Forum features authors, activists, artists, and healers working to increase our appreciation of the interconnectedness of life on Earth. Each week, we explore a new topic that impacts our health, our families, our communities, our work, and our environment. Our goal is not just to discuss present challenges, but to develop an awareness of root causes and, importantly, to explore potential solutions. At Oasis Forum, our aim is to inspire hope and share practical ideas for creating a world that works for all. And welcome to Oasis Forum. This is John Michael Dumais, and this is March 6th, 2005, and we appreciate you joining us tonight. We are happy to have in our studio tonight with us John W. Frady of Peterborough. John is a Peterborough resident, the executive director of Worldview Limited, a Peterborough-based nonprofit organization that he founded in 1991. Worldview's educational projects include environmental, economic, and social justice issues. Mr. Frady also serves as the Social Justice Chair for the Peterborough Unitarian Church, Vice Chair of the New Hampshire Unitarian Universalist Social Responsibility Department. He was named Chair for the New Hampshire Faithful Democracy Group, which originated as a voter empowerment project for New Hampshire Unitarian Universalists, and now serves as a resource committed to strengthening social justice advocacy across New Hampshire. John has been involved with all different kinds of things, including being on the advisory board for the Keene Basement Adnock Freedom Forum, of which I'm also a member. He holds a master's degree in environmental studies from Antioch New England Graduate School and a bachelor's degree in environmental studies from SUNY Purchase. And in 2003, he helped lead the local effort for Peterborough to adopt a resolution in defense of civil liberties at a town meeting. Mr. Frady has had 10 years' experience in the nonprofit sector with an emphasis on development-related responsibilities, including assignments as the Director of Development at the Groton, Mass-based National River Watershed Association, the Development Coordinator for Antioch New England Institute and Grants Program, Coordinator for the Center of Environmental Education, both in Keene. He's, as you can tell, done a lot of different things. We certainly have appreciated having him as part of our advisory staff at the Freedom Forum, and it's been very helpful in terms of helping focus our efforts and seeing the larger picture. He has a library that I hope he'll talk about that is the envy of a lot of my friends I know, and it's certainly a wonderful collection of things having to do with all things sustainable and beyond. And so welcome to the show, John. And we need to make sure we get this. Wait a minute. Let's try that one more time. Welcome.
Thank you, John Michael. You're too kind.
Well, thanks for being here on a night that it may snow and you might not be able to get back over the hill well. So we want to just kind of lay out the broad agenda. We're going to be talking about a lot of things relating to how the global economy affects the local economy, including things like sovereignty, investment rights, procurement of services such as health care, education, water, the issue of outsourcing, and also upcoming trade legislation, both federal, state, and local, including warrant articles on water. There's a lot that I want to get into tonight with you, John. So, again, welcome to the show. And can we just jump right in and start talking about the issue of sovereignty? What is sovereignty as it relates to the global economy and the local economy and local governance?
Well, many people think about sovereignty, and they think about the ability to have self-governance, and when that is taken away from them, their sovereignty is removed. And in the trade rules as they are unfolding these days, it has become an issue front and center.
Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit more about how our sovereignty maybe is being eclipsed by global trade rules. What's happening? I think people may be familiar with the issue of privatization in other countries, of privatization of water and other utilities and that sort of thing. And I think maybe not as familiar with how this whole issue of sovereignty affects us locally, here in New Hampshire and our local communities, as well as in other states around the country. So what is the...
Yeah, well, as a New Hampshire citizen who's really committed to a strong local economy, I've become very familiar with the impacts of international trade agreements on sovereignty, and local self-reliance is another way I like to phrase it. and investment protections written into trade agreements such as NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, and other recent and pending trade agreements, they grant foreign investors rights that are a direct threat to self-governance and local sovereignty. And that's one aspect of this very complex issue, but it's very clear, and it's of great concern to citizens and policymakers, irrespective of whether you're, you know, from a blue state or a red state, etc.
Mm-hmm. So which aspects of our local economy are at risk when we talk about sovereignty? What is it that we're in danger of losing control of?
Well, the sovereignty issue itself just relates, you know, to we on a local level here in state government have certain rules that we can make, and federal government has a different area that it operates. And in the case of just governing our quality of life through passing regulations to protect our air or water, our zoning regulations, say we want to limit growth in one part of our city and concentrate industrial activity in another part of the city, you know, these sorts of local decisions, those are all of a sudden on the trading block, because in the new trade agreements, they are viewed as an impediment to trade. And someone might be in a position of losing future profit if you somehow limit their ability to operate through these types of decisions, which we would normally consider to be reasonable decisions to make.
So do you want to talk about the example of Methanex in California? I know that was something that...
That's brought up a lot, Judge R. Michael. It's used to illustrate the benefits that are being granted to foreign corporations through the trade dispute process. It is one of the mechanisms, whether it's the World Trade Organization or whether it's the investor rules out of NAFTA, they do not weigh the non-economic values that citizens hold dearly in the same light as they do the economic values. And in fact, the non-democratic a way in which these mechanisms are, these disputes are resolved is one of the more offensive aspects of the whole issue. In fact, three trade lawyers get to decide whether your local law is an infraction or not, and they don't have to have any expertise actually in the issue itself. They just have to know, say, the trade law, and they're sort of faceless, and it's not a democratic, open court process that we would like to think our laws are upheld in.
So does New Hampshire have any representation on these trade councils?
No.
No, it doesn't. Well, that seems pretty bizarre in this day and age. And so what about constitutional protections?
Well, let's just look at this case of Methanex, because it sort of gives you a larger picture to examine how the trade rules have worked. There was a corporation in New Zealand, Methanex, and after NAFTA was formed, which involved Canada, Mexico, and the U.S., it relocated to Canada to take advantage of some of the investment and commercial benefits accrued to corporations in NAFTA. So now the Canadian, formerly New Zealand corporation, Methanex, which produces the M in MBTE, the gasoline additive,
right,
was involved in producing this product, which was linked to the contamination of groundwater out in California, where citizens there had passed ordinances to ban these storage tanks and whatnot.
And it should
they
be-
decided to sue the U.S. Treasury for $970 million, nearly $1 billion, and rather than have that even be laughed out of court, it was actually received as a reasonable legal dispute to be further discussed, which I think is disgusting.
And is there, that's just amazing. That's terrifying, really, at one level. And what is the outcome of that? Has that been determined yet, or is it still in process?
Well, they determined that it was worthy of further review, and that's the last I know about it.
Uh-huh. And there's another example. I think it's helpful to kind of nail down some of the ways in which these policies have been implemented. There's another example of a case in Mexico, if I'm not mistaken. with a toxic waste dump. Can you talk about that one as well? And just give
yeah. We're, once again, just to sort of frame it again for listeners who are just tuning in, the idea of a global economy and how it affects us here locally, it's when it really, you know, when the rubber hits the road here locally is when it makes a big impact. And the cases we're talking about now relate to investor protections and ways in which the U.S. Treasury and basic rules of self-governance are violated due to the way the rules are structured. There's other aspects of how it makes it relevant locally, but in terms of your question, Metalclad was a California-based corporation that wanted to it purchased a facility in Mexico that it wanted to expand as a hazardous waste facility. Unfortunately, it was quite a geologically sensitive area that they were operating in, and the local government denied them the necessary permits, which, of course, was not viewed well in the shareholder room and stockholder room at the Metalclad board offices in California. But at any rate, they decided to sue the Mexican Treasury for $90 million, which is more than the sum total per capita of everyone living in the entire state of San Luis Potosí, where that operation was. So it was really an absurd amount of money. In the end, they were actually given a $16.7 million settlement, which in and of itself is absurd.
Again, fairly scary to see something that local people haven't had any voice in creating or any input in at all, trumping local laws. And if we look at New Hampshire, what do you see as, in terms of the issue of sovereignty, as the most, shall we say, challenged or at-risk area for us to be thinking about here in the state of New Hampshire?
Well, I would want to just report some unfortunate news. There was an effort recently in the state legislature to create a commission so that future trade agreements would be reviewed by commission empowered by this legislature to protect our sovereignty. And this type of commission has already been established in Maine, and it's been investigating the impacts of trade agreements on self-governance. And unfortunately, in New Hampshire, although Chuck Weed from Keene introduced it, and Chris Roberts, who's also from Keene, supported it in the committee discussions, it was termed inexpedient to legislate. So there have been some legislative approaches to protect sovereignty, and I think it's important to recognize that the sovereignty debate focuses on the shifting balance of power. This is a situation in which the shift away from the state legislators and away from the national courts and away from the public, this whole process leads in which the voters are very much less able to hold elected officials accountable. And the trade policy which results in this scenario is much less accessible and accountable to the people of each nation, and more accessible and responsive to the multinational corporations that don't even see themselves as citizens to a particular country. The commission in Maine and the proposed New Hampshire commission are really not arguments against trade. They're not saying trade is bad, let's go break a Starbucks window or some such nonsense. They're really arguments in favor of assuring that trade agreements do not undermine local self-governance, not to mention environmental and labor provisions, which is not even on the table in this discussion.
Yes, when corporations are only looking at the bottom line, they are only caring. They're not caring about, you know, what's good for the community. And already, and we'll be talking about this a little bit later, outsourcing. But it's worth mentioning here that you know, several companies have already pulled up stakes here, or are about to pull up stakes here, and don't really, you know, have a stake in the community, which is not.
And it was helpful for me some time ago to hear this presentation about from the words of this Henry Charles Carey individual, and it was about the notion of what is trade versus, say, what is the notion of commerce. Because naturally, our local economy, our well-being, the well-being of our families, our forebears, you know, our descendants, All commerce is going to be involved in that. And what's the distinction between that and trade? And so some of the terms that are most correctly associated with commerce are concepts like short-distance exchange, building community by binding together its productive elements. There's a combination of commerce. And in trade, the counterbalance to the short-distance exchange is trade occurs over a long distance. And when you build community through commerce, actually the trade will be undermining community by separating those who have the fundamental decisions that affect their future from those who live within the consequence of those decisions. And commerce nurtures local ownership, but trade really spawns absentee ownership. And commerce really encourages self-reliance, but trade encourages dependence. So it's important to recognize that these commissions don't argue against trade or growth. The concept is we want to define it in terms of commerce and the benefits of commerce and not get in a situation where we're promoting the instability of our self-reliance. And this concept of commerce and trade is I think, fundamental to the kind of reforms that are going to be the solution to these issues.
And as you know, one of my favorite issues is supporting local economies. And, you know, what would you say, you know, is the good a good balance between a local economy and national or international trade, you know, coming into any communities? Can that be determined? You know, what is the effect of Walmarts and big box stores and other large, you know, utilities or whatever on local economies? Can you just, you know, while we're on that topic, just give any commentary on that?
Well, if you're going to be talking about community economic development models and what are appropriate sizes in which certain things are possible in terms of sustainability and thresholds, I think that's a separate discussion. And I want to come back because, as you know, I'll be an ongoing contributor and we'll be talking about civil liberties and community economic development models and these types of things in the future. In terms of the Walmart issue you brought up, I just want to say that we have a situation here in New Hampshire which is somewhat disturbing. Walmart is our state's largest private employer, and it offers more than low prices. Its wages are so low that many of the employees turn to the public for support. And earlier this year, a congressional study found that a typical Walmart store actually costs taxpayers $2,000 per worker in medical care, school lunches, housing subsidies, and other welfare services. So if our New Hampshire economy is going to pursue that model, a Walmart economy, I think we can do better, you know. And the impact on the unions is obvious, Walmart and unions. It's kind of an oxymoron. And, you know, the problem is the economy spawns wage earners who are unable to meet their needs. And the manufacturing jobs, which have been the hallmark of the Bush policy, specifically the fleeing of manufacturing jobs from New Hampshire. In fact, since President Bush took office, New Hampshire's lost over 24% of its manufacturing jobs, the highest rate of any state in the country.
That's right.
Over 26,000 manufacturing jobs have been lost in the Granite State since January 2001. But as I was saying,
and another few hundred just recently. Right here in the local area.
The jobs that are replacing them do not provide the wage earners with the ends meet. And the premium software jobs, well, forget it. It's relentless. The offshoring of high-tech jobs is hitting communities like Merrimack and Nashua front and center. A lot of software engineers losing their jobs, going out and speaking at community forums. It's the word's getting out, but the policymakers are still slow to react.
And on that note, let's take a little bit break, and when we come back, we'll continue this conversation about how New Hampshire jobs are being impacted. And we'll also open the lines for some phone calling. So if you want to ask John Friede a question, you can give us a call at 358-8863. That's 358-8863. And we will return in just a second with a little bit more. Thanks for joining us.
Every student in the world should have an education in the arts. Arts is a key tool in self-expression. We are all born creative, but if we neglect to develop and strengthen these skills, our creativity becomes inhibited. By assisting and encouraging a child's creativity, you set the stage for endless opportunities for that child's imagination. A healthy imagination not only creates a resourceful and productive individual, but it also builds self-esteem, which is an important tool that will be used for the rest of that child's life. When a child creates a work of art, they are not just drawing a picture, they are also creating aspects of self-importance, individuality, and engaging in self-expression. And for self-expression, it is the way to understanding in this confusing world.
Hi, I'm Larry Welkowitz. This summer, every Friday from 11 to 12, you can hear Free Speech on WKNH Keene. Free Speech, an opportunity for you to come on the air, to come on the show, and say whatever you want to say. Free Speech, every Friday from 11 to 12 on WKNH Keene. I'm sitting right here with former Keene State College student Andy Sylvia. Andy, did you ever listen to Free Speech when it's been on in the past?
No, but I intend to in the future if I have a radio. Hopefully I can afford one now that I'm no longer in college.
Well, there you go. So join Andy Sylvia and throngs of other people this summer who every Friday from 11 to 12 will tune into Free Speech. Andy, maybe we'll even have you as a guest this summer.
Well, thanks. You want to give me a radio?
Oh, gosh. I thought you were making some money finally. No?
Still got those loans to pay off.
Okay. See you later. Free Speech.
And this is John Michael Dumais, and you are listening to Oasis Forum here on WKNH 91.3. And in our studios is John Friede, a Peterborough resident who's also the executive director of Worldview Limited, which is a Peterborough-based nonprofit organization he founded in 1991. He also serves as the social justice chair for the Peterborough Unitarian Church and is an advisor to the Banana Freedom Forum and lots of other things going on around here having to do with citizen governance, local economies, civil rights, social and economic justice, and we're happy to have you on the program again, John. Thanks for joining us.
John Michael.
And we want to remind our listeners...
Always heavy with the bio.
Hey,
we have to work on that.
We want to let people know who you are. Hey, I'm only reading about one-third of what you gave me, man. And the number here is 358-8863. Give us a call if you want to ask John Friede a question about any of these things that we're talking about. And where we left before the break was on the sort of the economic outlook in New Hampshire. You were talking about how the laid-off manufacturing workers end up making less than they were in their old jobs. I guess 13% less is one estimate.
All the way up to 25%.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so why is it that New Hampshire is shedding manufacturing jobs?
Oh, well, of course, the wages that people get paid, even if they aren't living wages, are certainly far more than what some corporations can get in places where they don't have weekends, for example, and places like that. But, of course, manufacturing jobs and the loss of that, that's not new information. What we were just getting onto is now how the high-tech jobs and some of these, say, like life science industry, which is largely white-collar work and heavy reliance on scientific innovation, we thought that scientific innovation sort of protected us and we would be able to retain those kind of jobs. Mm-hmm. And now we're finding out that they are more vulnerable. And, in fact, some of the folks who come over and get degrees and then go home, you know, that's, believe it or not, an impact on that dimension there. So there's outsourcing on different levels.
Mm-hmm.
And what does outsourcing mean when we have an economy such as the one we were just talking about before the break?
Mm-hmm.
And well, there's different things that we can do. You know, when we have low-wage, low-benefit jobs, there's less disposable income, and that means we really have, you know, less money and there's less sales for retailers. And when there's less disposable income, that means shopping and discount chains, just Walmart and that sort of thing, is the tendency. And jobs without health coverage, of course, is no nothing uncommon to listeners. And the voters in Vermont last week in a couple dozen towns about universal health care spoke out at town meetings with ordinances and resolutions and that sort of thing. And And in New Hampshire, we did a good job with that at town meeting a couple of years ago. But the economy that is linked with the outsourcing is going to be generating low-income jobs, less able to attract and retain the higher-skilled, higher-income working. Tax revenues will be strained, schools, you know, but this is not unique to New Hampshire. States across the country are losing good wage jobs to trade. However, New Hampshire could do a lot more to counterbalance those losses than many other states. We have a lot of economic strengths. We have a skilled, motivated workforce. We have a lot of tools to strengthen wages and improve our local self-reliance and jobs for the long-term economy. Mm-hmm. Governor Benson, the former governor, rather, really underutilized those tools. And under Governor Lynch, we have new opportunities. So there's a lot of policy options, but those are pretty boring. So I'll stay away from that right about now.
Well, I mean, it would be good to know a little bit about what, you know, what can be done, because I don't want to leave the listeners with the feeling of, oh, my God, look what's happening. And
well, I'll tell you one thing we can, like, try and avoid, for example.
Sure.
Here's something you don't want to do. In the late 1990s, New Hampshire contracted with Citibank to switch its food stamp program over from paper coupons to debit cards.
Mm-hmm.
And this was going to help, you know, food stamp recipients with questions. And then the contractor is going to set up one of those help call lines. Well, guess what? A bunch of that work ended up in India.
Mm-hmm.
So here's this bitter irony in which New Hampshire's taxpayer dollars are employing people in India to find out. And what they're doing is they're answering questions about how much they need jobs back at home. The irony was just way too much. Former state Senator Bert Cohen was outraged, and let a lot of people know about that.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing, the kind of thing we can avoid. We can do a lot better than that.
So as we, you know, talk about the effect on the New Hampshire economy itself, are there, you know, is there any upcoming legislation besides the ones that you mentioned before about trying to, you know, protect our trade, you know, our trade status, I guess, to protect our local sovereignties, or anything else that's going on there?
Well, there's a number of pieces of legislation. I think probably most compelling is what's happening tomorrow. There's a couple of minimum wage votes down in Washington in the Senate. The U.S. Senate, through an agreement between party leadership, two distinct federal minimum wage amendments will be offered for up or down vote on this bankruptcy legislation they're doing. This is Monday, March 7th. That's tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
So here's what you need to know about these two amendments. And certainly if there was some action, as we saw with the death penalty for juvenile situation last week, if there's a federal legislation success, that changes the dimension of what we can do here locally. Anyway, the first amendment by Kennedy in the Senate calls for an increase in the federal minimum wage up to $7.25 by 2007 in three stages. It's similar to a bill from last session, and the New Hampshire Faithful Democracy is supporting this amendment. Obviously, there's another amendment. This is the Rick Santorum amendment. It raises it to $6.25, and it includes a provision changing overtime rules. Unfortunately, these changes actually worked to cut the overtime pay for millions of workers. So that's not a particularly attractive amendment. The Kennedy Amendment is one that our federal representatives need to hear about tomorrow. Of course, Senator Gregg and Senator Sununu primarily on that one. And I hope listeners can find those numbers.
Wonderful. Thank you. And while we're on the issue of wage, you know about the living wage initiatives that have been going on for a number of years, which is I don't know if you want to talk anything about that, but I think it's another. It's not connected with the minimum wage thing that you were just talking about, but that it has been something that people have been discussing for quite some time, and that is trying to bring, you know, a basic standard of living, a standard of wages. Unfortunately, this living wage tends to only relate to.
Well, you know, whether you're talking about, you know, sorry to interrupt, but whether it's minimum wage or living, what you're talking about is kind of like dignity. You know, mm-hmm. If you can't have dignity in the wage you're earning, then something is need of fixing.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, most Americans believe that hard work, you know, pays off. You know, our grandparents and parents always told us you need to, you know, make a contribution to greater, you know, community. You pull you up by the bootstraps, the theory goes, and the American dream is right around the corner.
Right.
And this dignity in our work is always been, I think, a real pride of our heritage and culture and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, with the economy running havoc, the wage discrepancies are abominable. And, you know, the New Hampshire Department of Employment Security estimates that 27,000 minimum wage workers in New Hampshire. And nationally, 60% of all minimum and low-wage jobs are filled by women, many of whom are single mothers struggling to pay for rent, food, heat, transportation, firewood, childcare, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
One step off the precipice and down they go. It's a high wire act for so many folks.
Mm-hmm.
And the minimum wage law is a very exciting story here in New Hampshire. On March 16th, there will be a hearing in the State House. Terry Norelli out of Portsmouth has introduced a legislation. I think it's a 665 House bill, or don't have that number in front of me, but there will be a hearing on the bill on the 16th. And the great opportunity for New Hampshire to join the rest of the states in New England with a better minimum wage.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And just reminding our viewers that you can give John Friede a call here and let us have some of your perspectives or questions, 358-8863. That's 358-8863. And, John, as we continue talking about this, we're really talking about the health and welfare of the folks right here in our own state, and how having a minimum wage would certainly help in that regard, especially given how many women are the ones getting that wage and how many of them are mothers as well. I know some personally. And what is your thought right now in terms of how education is being funded and the additional squeeze that's being felt by property owners in terms of the property tax? I know a lot of people say, well, you know, we don't have an income tax, and, you know, we don't have a statewide sales tax, so why should we complain about the property tax? But I know that for myself, my taxes have gone up by almost 300% since 2001, and I don't know if there's any end in sight. And this is not a sustainable picture either, especially for folks on limited incomes and fixed incomes.
Well, as you know, John Michael, I ran unsuccessfully for the State House, and anybody running for the State House or elected office talks about funding and education funding. And you can't dodge the bullet on this. Depending where you live, you have a little more leverage. Here in Cheshire County, for a state rep to have a position that represents his constituency or her constituency, the position of a tax and, you know, getting rid of the property tax statewide and possibly having an income or sales tax. These are considerations. In Durham, it's a possibility. In Keene, it's a possibility. In many other places in New Hampshire, it's a lot harder to do and be an effective or even an elected official. So I've observed and learn a lot from people who have been doing this for decades, and I'm still plugging away, trying to support those who have much more sophisticated ideas than I do on this subject. You know, there's folks at the New Hampshire Center for Public Policy and whatnot that do some fine work that allows you to get a good handle on the issue.
And let's moving on here to an issue of investment rights relative, again, to this effect of the global economy on the local economy. Did we? Did you want to cover some stuff on that?
Well, I think it's sometimes important just to reiterate, you know, we covered it sort of in passing before, but, you know, whether you're talking about the service industry or investor rights, the trade agreements that are on the table, I'm speaking about the Central American Free Trade Agreement, CAFTA, which the top Republican strategists are counting the votes, and I think they need about 25 Democrats to make that work. And they're thinking about bringing that out as soon as possible, or some of the other trade agreements that are out there. The industries of services have traditionally not been those that have been auctioned off. When you think about trade, that's one thing. But services refers to just about anything that is bought and sold but can't be dropped on your foot. You know, like there's... they are classified. Services are classified by the World Trade Organization in 144 sectors and subsectors, including business, services, communications, financial, retail, trade, social services, et cetera, et cetera. And in the end, they stick in this catch-all category, which is other services not included elsewhere. So these descriptions of services are new. Anyway, the manufacturing situation has been very difficult in the economy, and the nosedive that's been occurring in the manufacturing has led to a U.S. economy which is very involved in services, and these are the jobs that are available. The big players, the financial services, the telecommunications services, software, entertainment, engineering, these transportation services, they're drooling at the prospect of commercial operations in markets all over the world. But what stands in their way is that another government somewhere else in another independent nation may actually be providing that service for their people. And so these new trade agreements look to take that sovereign right of that nation away in order for the corporation to have these new powers and profits.
It reminds me of a program I was watching the other day on Free Speech TV, Vandana Shiva, I'm sure you're familiar with, talking about Monsanto trying to, I guess, corner the market on, you know, through patents on certain kinds of wheat that have been grown, you know, traditionally in India and being, you know, with women being the seed keepers for, you know, millennia, literally millennia. And now you've got corporations coming in and trying to say, no, actually, we have that patent.
Yeah, the services is kind of an abstract. I'd like to give an example that kind of brings it sharply into focus. There's, you know, United Parcel Service, we all know, UPS. Well, Canada has a different way of dealing with services than the U.S. Their health services are notoriously different than ours, et cetera, et cetera. Postal services are no different. They're housed within the government buildings. They are a government service. It's totally not a commercial operation. And UPS decided to sue Canada under NAFTA rules, claiming that the Canadian Postal Service package delivery is unfair competition. They couldn't make a buck in Canada with this service that this country had deemed reasonable to provide to its citizens. So we have legal cases which are kind of litmus test to what sort of thinking is going on in this area. But here in our own community, zoning rules are up for grabs in New Hampshire, water rules. If the U.S. Springs contract continues to move forward and for some reason some other information comes up, any corporation seeking a water contract anywhere, that's a commercial activity that would become more important than the local regulatory apparatus. And this is something very real.
Could you go into a little bit more detail about U.S. Springs for those who may not be familiar with that particular case, just, you know, what's been going on there and what were they trying to do here in New Hampshire?
Well, I'm not an expert on that subject exactly, but I have learned of the great efforts of the Save Our Groundwater community organization mm-hmm. in the Barrington area, where the water supply for the 10-town area is in dire straits as a result of a contract the DES in New Hampshire has approved to the tune of 358,000 gallons per day, something to that effect.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been looking to bring the case to the state Supreme Court, and there's a various legal and other citizen-related strategies that are being pursued because people really don't want their water to be bottled up and sent away. And the subject came up in the hearing before the State House when Chuck Weed had his legislation to establish the commission and to evaluate the sovereignty issue. And unfortunately, the state reps on that committee were not sufficiently well-versed, shall we say, in the subject to allow them to manage the information that was being clearly testified to them as well as written down and handed to them. As a result, one of them, in fact, Christensen, I believe, from Hudson or some such place, said that he thought he was lied to by the person from Save Our Groundwater because they had said that USA Springs was a foreign corporation, as if that matters. Whether they are or not, the fact is the water is going to go over to Europe and some corporation is going to pocket it, and the people in the 10-town area are going to end up holding the bag.
Mm-hmm.
How shall I say, level of sophistication which with this issue was treated was not very impressive, and they all played hot the potato because they wanted to pretend that the issue should have presented to the Commerce Committee, not the State and Federal Affairs Committee. Chris Roberts, the local state rep, did a fine job, thanks to Chuck for bringing it to the rep's attention, but we identified a clear area where there's some opportunities for educating our reps on this issue.
Mm-hmm. And on that note, we're going to take another quick little break and remind you once again, if you want to give us a call and ask us your questions, live and on the air, just give us a buzz at 358-8863, and we'll be right back to talk a little bit more about the effects of global economy on the local economy. Thanks for joining us.
Sort of break it down like this.
Are you up with today's beat? That's B-E-A-T, by the way. Recently, beats have enjoyed a culinary comeback supported by a strong nutritional profile. Today's trendy restaurants feature the savory vegetable in salads, roast trays, and side dishes. Now you can, too. Sweet and tangy pickled beets packed in glass jars make this food trend easy to duplicate at home. Add sliced pickled beets to favorite salads. Feature whole pickled beets on a relish tray. Heat pickled beets in a microwave-ready jar and serve as a side dish. Jar-packed pickled beets also pack in vitamins, minerals, and antioxidants. Antioxidants are dietary substances and foods believed to be key in promoting good health and may help prevent problems such as heart disease, cancer, and memory loss. For a free brochure with more information about beets, including delicious recipes and serving suggestions, log on to www.senecafoods.com and click on Free Beet Brochure.
Do you like jazz? Real jazz? Then join me, Bill Hay, every Thursday at high noon for 2 hours of real jazz. We'll listen to and talk about America's art form, from its beginnings in New Orleans in 1917, through big band and swing, bebop and cool jazz, the West Coast sound and hard bop, fusion and free jazz, and the fine young artists of today. We'll hear royalty, from the Duke to the Count to Earl Father Hines, and the Preds, Billy and Sarah and Ella, Bird and Train and Diz, Getz and Brew and Mulligan, instrumentals and vocals and vocalese. 2 hours of the best music there is. That's real jazz every Thursday from noon to 2 p.m. right here on WKNH 91.3 FM, Keene State College Radio.
And thanks for joining us on Oasis Forum this March 6, 2005. And we have in our studio and have been talking to John Freedy of Worldview Limited, the director of Worldview in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and very involved in local and state politics. And just before the break, as a segue before we get into our final issues here of discussion, you were talking about the state representatives perhaps not being as up on things as they could. And what is your view about the fact that that our elected officials who serve in the House and the Senate are not paid and have to give a lot of their own free time and perhaps don't, you know, with all the work that they do, don't have time to, you know, get out and learn as much as maybe perhaps some others have who've, you know, studied this for many, many years. What is your thought on that?
Yeah, well, we have a very large legislative body, of course, so trying to figure out a way to provide them with an appropriate wage and whatnot presents an entirely interesting problem. But suffice it to say that it's these civic institutions that allow for, you know, our interests to be represented, and we need to think of thoughtful ways to keep them, you know, responsive and sound. you know, we've been talking about, you know, what the U.S. trade policy has been doing, what's at stake for us locally, and, you know, there's been a lot of discussion about trade in the political world. Most of it's focused on decisions from 10 years ago, namely the passage of NAFTA and the creation of the World Trade Organization. And it's important to assess the impact of those agreements, but it's also equally important for us to keep an eye on proposals to create new regional free trade agreements modeled on NAFTA and the ongoing proposals for change in the WTO system of global trade rules.
Mm-hmm. And so what do you see as the critical issues that need to be addressed there?
Well, you know, currently the U.S. is involved with several sets of trade negotiations, including talks with 33 countries to create the Free Trade Area of the Americas, mm-hmm. talks at the World Trade Organization, talks to expand the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. As I mentioned, the talks to create the Central American Free Trade Area, CAFTA.
Mm-hmm.
The U.S. is pursuing and or has secured trade deals with lots of other folks, Dominican Republic, a bunch of Andean countries, Bolivia, Colombia, Peru, and Ecuador, all quite recently. Outside of Latin America, the Bush administration is negotiating trade deals with and has secured trade deals with Australia, Morocco, in negotiation with five South African countries, and there's some new trade talks with Bahrain and Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
So there's quite a lot that in some cases even the state of New Hampshire is getting signed on to that we need to be aware of. But what we can look at is the agenda in general as defined by the Bush administration.
Yes.
And what they're looking at is an expanded rights for investors and the transnational corporations, limited protections, if any, for the labor rights or the environment, insufficient attention to the interests of the developing countries on issues as important as food security, for example.
That's right.
The U.S. was, and the Bush administration trade agenda was dealt setbacks at the Cancun meetings in Mexico and WTO meetings in September 93, again at the Miami FTAA talks in November of 03, some setbacks. In both cases, the developing countries put up resistance to the U.S. corporate agenda.
Mm-hmm.
As a result, the Bush administration is now putting much more emphasis on bilateral agreements, such as the ones that I mentioned, in these small countries, and it's easier for them to negotiate in that respect,
mm-hmm,
you can imagine.
Well, at least they have a voice at the table, and I know that, you know, in, I said it was 99, the WTO meeting in Seattle, and the WTO and the media and the government were not ready, I think, for the kind of public outcry. They saw quite a coalition of people, you know, showing up to offer an alternative view and, you know, let the world know that perhaps you know, certain of these trade agreements, as you mentioned, are not good for people, not good for labor, not good for the environment. Do you see these bilateral agreements as being better for labor, for the environment?
Well, the investment and service companies and their proxies in the Bush administration, from these free trade agreements, as they're known, what they basically want to do is sweep away any regulations that stand in the way of their profits and mm-hmm. displace the public sector programs that might compete with them,
mm-hmm.
construction, education, healthcare, utilities. Brazil, Costa Rica, Venezuela, Argentina are not following Washington's script.
That's right.
If they gain additional allies, the agenda is going to face stormier prospects. And it's a question of who's going to write the modern rules of the 21st century economy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, former U.S. trade rep Robert Zoellick, I think he's with the State Department now,
mm-hmm.
Had a meeting December 03 where he was lauding the economy to the corporate elite and talking about how they were rewriting they're making new rules for the modern 21st century economy. And unfortunately, they were rules that left out all the things that we were just talking about. And so the question really is, who is going to write those rules?
Mm-hmm.
Are we going to allow these rules to be written by the Zoellicks of our day, or are we going to find other voices?
Well, I know the World Social Forum, which I'm sure you're familiar with, has been getting larger and larger every year. I guess this year was 180,000, perhaps, that met in Porto Alegre, Brazil. And they are trying to corral an alternative voice and maybe some visions of alternative citizen governance. Can you predict for us, maybe, or give us a scenario in which there would be more democracy and more, you know, direct input from the world's citizens on these types of agreements?
Well, I have in my hands is the Global Platform for the Struggle of Water, an English translation.
Mm-hmm.
It was debated and prepared by civil society groups during the World Social Forum in Porto Alegre, Brazil, in January of 2005.
Mm-hmm.
It's still being refined. I believe it's now ready for group signature. And the document is now something that when we advocate for water as something that shouldn't be a commodity, but more as a human right or a service that the public is entitled to, there is certainly a nice tapestry to draw from when you have a proclamation such as this stemming from the World's Social Forum.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think the prospects are for something like this, which doesn't have, you know, doesn't have the weight of law? There's no, you know, in terms of the way governments and businesses typically operate, they're not being invited necessarily into those boardrooms and trade negotiations. So, you know, what do you see something like the World Social Forum eventually becoming, if anything? Do you see this eventually becoming something like a global world parliament that would be truly representative in a way currently that the UN is not, and of course these other organizations that we've been talking about, the WTO, the IMF?
No, I haven't thought about that much.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly an incubator for global civil society to put its best ideas forward and talk shop mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. But
mm-hmm.
Any sort of interaction of that sort is positive. In the few remaining minutes, we wanted to speak briefly about two issues. One was minimum wage, and the second was CAFTA.
Go on.
And once again, those are the two upcoming votes that we would anticipate. Tomorrow being a vote that's going to take place down in Washington. So Senator Gregg should be contacted. And I apologize, I don't have his phone number to read at you ad nauseum right now. But Senator Gregg and Senator Sununu, you all can consider letting them know that the Kennedy Amendment, bringing up to 725 in three stages, is a nice step in the right direction, and he should consider that as a worthy amendment. The Santorum Amendment, of course, with its actual resultant cut in wage, is not the direction we want to be heading. Sununu, the same message. So minimum wage is one thing, but, you know, it's tough here in New Hampshire. You know, in New Hampshire, $5.15 an hour. So a head of a household or a family would have to actually work about 70 hours a week just to meet the federal definition of poverty. I mean, this isn't some abstract issue here, you know. And I don't know. If I'm working 70 hours a week, I definitely want to be rising above poverty. So The issue in New Hampshire is further exacerbated by the archaic policy our state has relative to those around us. We just failed by one vote during the last legislative session, so it looks very promising on the March 16th session.
John, I've got that number for Judd Gregg if people want to give him a call. In Washington, it's 202-224-3324. And the Concord office here in the state, 603-225-7115. And that's how you can get in touch with them and talk to them about your feelings and thoughts on the minimum wage issue.
And so minimum wage, we have the opportunity tomorrow to support the Kennedy Amendment. We have the opportunity to support the Norelli legislation, the House bill in the state in March, a couple weeks. And in terms of CAFTA, it's very difficult to imagine. You can't predict exactly what's happening. The Republican CAFTA supporters in the House, they want to take it up within the next 2 or 3 months. Sources say they're going to need about 20 to 25 Democrats to approve the agreement. The Washington Trade Daily reports that the point man for the GOP, who's Republican Kevin Brady out of Texas, told a D.C. forum that they have the votes they need in the House, but the other House Republicans say it's too early to count votes because people are sitting on the fence. Meanwhile, down in Central America, the representative organization countries that are in the agreement are ratifying it. Individual countries ratify it. There's a whole process. You get the agreement, and then the countries ratify it. It's a whole process. Well, Honduras on March 3rd became the second Latin American nation after El Salvador to ratify the proposed agreement. However, the lawmakers immediately fled Congress out the back door to avoid 1,000 government employees opposed to CAFTA who were protesting in front of the building, according to the Associated Press.
Mm-hmm.
Guatemala's Congress announced Wednesday that it was going to delay a vote on CAFTA to consider similar arguments from PAC opponents there, or perhaps build a back door so they can get out. 8,000 protesters in Guatemala, including teachers, workers, farmers, and academics, waged a massive street protest on March 1st. So, civil unrest about this agreement is certainly not cooling off, and Bush is counting his votes.
Wonderful. And on that note, John, we've come to the end of the hour, and we certainly thank you for sharing your thoughts on the effects of the global economy on the local economy. We know there's so much more to talk about here. We've only really just hit the tip of the iceberg. I hope you come back and explore some of these other connected issues with us, civil liberties.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Thanks for coming on. And we'll be back in just a few more minutes with Oasis Journeys, the second hour of Oasis, your Oasis evening here on WKNH. And stay tuned. And you're listening to WKNH 91.3 Keene.